Now, when I was a kid, food was food. Where our scientific magicians poisoned the water, polluted the soil, decimated plant and animal life. Why, in my day, you could buy meat anywhere. Eggs they had, real butter, fresh lettuce in the stores.
I know, Saul, you told me before.
How can anything survive in a climate like this? A heat wave all year long.
The greenhouse effect. Everything is burning up.
Avast me hearties, it's another edition of Radio EcoShock. Today I'm your humble guide to mysteries of the high seas. We have three guests, every one of them a leading scientist, and all agreed that ocean life is under threat, dying. On two continents, at two eminent gatherings, the research is coming in. In Monaco, environment ministers from over 100 countries received a special report from the United Nations Environment Program. We will call Norway to interview the lead author of the UNEP report that nobody in North America has heard about. It's called In Dead Water. But we'll begin in Boston at the February meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. Again, new ocean science poured out: overfishing, pollution, climate change, the last century of the coral reefs.
We really need to recognize that this is an emergency. This is code red, code blue, whatever. And if we don't start taking actions both to, as I say, help things locally and address the issue of CO2 emissions, we are not going to be very happy with the world that we pass on to our children and our grandchildren.
There are no voters, no taxpayers, no voices in the sea. But we will listen and stretch ourselves beyond our usual shores. The ocean needs our help just as we depend upon it. There is nothing simple here. What could be more complex, more fluid, more alive than the sea? The currents are changing, the species are changing, the temperature is changing. The sea we thought we knew is becoming a myth, disappearing into history. At the famous Smithsonian Institute in America, there is a chair of marine studies. It belongs to the eminent biologist Nancy Knowlton. And if American scientists are supposed to be timid, under a muzzle about the dire threat of climate change, someone forgot to tell Nancy Knowlton. We'll talk to her now. The latest meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science was in Boston this February. It held a lot of news about the state of our oceans. To help sort this out, we're joined by an award-winning scientist, Dr. Nancy Knowlton, currently the Sant Chair for Marine Science at the Smithsonian. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Alex.
Well, there were a flurry of announcements about ocean science at the AAAS meeting. Why is this such a hot area of research, do you think?
Well, I think it's a hot area of research because so many different directions are of research are heading in the same final destination, which is that the state of the oceans is really bad. And it's because of a whole host of factors, some of which are local and some of which are global, but they all point to really a crisis situation. And the sense of a crisis has been building, but it just came to a head, I think, at this latest AAAS meeting.
Well, there are two issues that seem sort of new to me and likely to our listeners that I'm trying to understand, and both are related to the impact of climate change on the sea life. And I'd like to start by looking at acidification. I knew this endangered billions of shell-forming organisms near the bottom of the food chain, and that's serious, but now it seems it could also create dead zones as well. Am I correct about that?
Well, acidification has a lot of its direct impacts, as you say, have to do with making it much harder for organisms to secrete their shells. But it may also just slow down their ability to grow and reproduce, even if they can sort of slowly make a skeleton. And some of these things are big, like or create big structures like corals. Others are really tiny, like little tiny members of the plankton that form the basis of food chains. So the repercussions of either eliminating or greatly reducing these shell builders from the tiniest to the largest could be quite substantial. And we actually, to be honest, we don't really know yet what the long-term consequences are going to be. This is one of the reasons there was so much energy about acidification at the meetings, was because we're just now starting to really collect information that giving us just a hint of what some of the likely consequences are going to be.
Well, what other impacts can we expect as the sea absorbs all the carbon and the excess heat from our greenhouse pollution?
Well, the CO2 has, as you say, two main effects. One is acidification, what sometimes I call the Coca-Cola ocean. Your mother may have told you not to drink too much Coca-Cola because it would dissolve away your teeth. So it's the same principle, and it, as I say, it makes it harder for organisms that need to build skeletons to do so. And then there's the whole issue of warming, about which people have been studying for longer, and so we have a much better handle on exactly how organisms are going to be responding. Some organisms, like corals, are in very serious danger from global warming because they live very close to the maximum temperature that they can survive. Corals have in their tissues single-celled plants that they depend on really for most or all of their food, and those plants start being unable to make food when the temperature gets above about 1 degree centigrade or 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the normal maximum for the area. And so this has led to, since the 1980s, increasingly frequent and increasingly severe episodes of what's called coral bleaching, which is when that relationship between the corals and their plant cells breaks down. Plants are evicted, and then the coral slowly starves to death, and will, if things don't get better, will die in the matter of a couple of months, or either directly from the heat or sometimes indirectly through disease. So that's those organisms are very severely affected. Then there are other organisms that might be prompted to, say, shift their ranges, and so you might get the appearance of normally equatorial species appearing in cooler waters. You might get wholesale shifts of ecosystems, including perhaps reefs, for that matter, up coasts. And the changes are so massive. When this sort of thing happened in geological past, you get wild rearrangements of communities, and it's really difficult for scientists to predict how what the total effect is going to be. What we do know is that when you radically change the physical characteristics of the ocean, you often wind up with massive extinctions, and so that is a concern as well.
Well, there's even predictions, and I guess this came out at the conference as well, that the crabs and sharks may invade the Antarctic waters for the first time for species there that have no protection against them.
That's right. I mean, this is why basically the world as you see it is used to conditions as you know it. So whenever you change the conditions, there's almost inevitably going to be reshuffling movements. Some things might do better, but a lot of things will probably do worse. And over millions of years, the ecosystem re-equilibrates and new forms of life appear. But in the short term, which is what the time frame that is of importance to people, it can be very chaotic and messy and with a lot of nasty surprises.
Well, I've heard Dr. James Lovelock saying that the seas may actually become more stable as they warm, perhaps less wave action and less circulation between the deep sea and the surface. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, this is not exactly my area of expertise. I'm really a coral reef biologist. I'm not a biological oceanographer. I know it may sound similar, but they're actually huge amounts of information in those different fields, and people tend to have a better command of their area of expertise. One thing that does seem to be coming out of the biological oceanography world, however, is the idea that the ocean will become more stratified, which is, as you say, the less mixing. And that can be bad for a number of reasons, including the productivity of the surface waters, which people depend on for food.
Well, let's pretend that a big government like the United States or China decided to act to preserve these top world fishing areas, but the budget is limited. Where would we begin? Would we go with greenhouse gas reduction or a trawling ban? Where should we concentrate our attention?
Well, I don't think it's wise to say, okay, we're going to do just this one thing. I think you need a suite of approaches, and it depends to some extent on the problem you're most interested in. I think I'll speak for coral reefs because I have a lot of expertise in coral reefs, and I would recommend for coral reefs a two-pronged approach. One is to really focus on reducing local stresses, and for coral reefs that means improving water quality and reducing overfishing. because by reducing local stresses, you make reef ecosystems better able to cope with change and catastrophe. You build what's called resilience. And so it's very, very important to make, to protect environments in such a way that they retain their resilient abilities to recover from the blows that nature inevitably gives, regardless of the role of people. On the other hand, I don't think you can ignore climate change. It's very important to remember that CO2 that we put in the atmosphere today is with us for literally centuries, 400, 500 years. And so you can't postpone that working on climate change, because every day, every week, every month, every year that you don't work to solve the problem of reducing emissions creates a problem that will last literally for centuries. So I think you do have to do both things.
What was some of the buzz at the American Academy meeting with the ocean folks? Did you hear about some other research coming that sounded interesting to you?
Well, there was so much that was going on. It was a little hard to specifically choose just a few. I did think we're starting to learn a lot more about the effects of acidification, and there's a lot of buzz about that, if you will, because our knowledge base is so small. We just don't have much of a sense of what is going to happen, and so any information is really a big improvement. And I think the other thing I think we're starting to get a better sense of, and this came out in the symposium that I was part of, but I also heard it mentioned elsewhere, is that the problem of these multiple threats, warming, acidification, and the other local threats actually have the potential to really get worse by being synergistic. And the more individual threats you place on an ecosystem in terms of stresses, the worse that they become. They multiply their negative impacts rather than just add up. And for example, one of the talks that was in our symposium talked about the double jeopardy of climate change, of warming and acidification, and that the organisms that were being studied, these little things called pteropods, which are part of the plankton, are an important part of the food chain for fishes in the Arctic and Antarctic waters. These pteropods, they can continue to build their skeletons in acidic water, but they become much, much more sensitive to heat. And so, as a consequence, they can deal with one threat, but the two together is really problematic.
Is there something else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I guess I'd like to tell your listeners that the situation with the oceans is really grave. In coral reefs, for example, we've already lost about 80% of all the living corals in the Caribbean, and the situation in the Pacific is comparably grim, and that we really need to recognize that this is an emergency. This is code red, code blue, whatever. And if we don't start taking actions both to, as I say, help things locally and address the issue of CO2 emissions, we are not going to be very happy with the world that we pass on to our children and our grandchildren.
Well, thank you a lot for stepping up and saying that. We've been speaking with Dr. Nancy Knowlton, a well-known authority on ocean science from the Smithsonian Institute. Thank you so much, Nancy.
You're very welcome.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, your source for environmental science and action. My friends, I got primed for this feature on the oceans because I couldn't believe what gets lost in the news. Like, pardon me, I don't mean to interrupt the multimedia snooze fest, but...
They've got to tell people.
Tell them what?
The ocean's dying. Plankton's dying.
Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle for food. You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them.
Our opening clips were from the 1973 sci-fi film Soylent Green, starring Charlton Heston. Can you believe that? 1973, and Mr. NRA gets the role actually foretelling the climatic future, using the words greenhouse effect even. In more recent science, we finally have a way to look at human impacts on the whole ocean. Californian scientist Ben Halpern has the world in his laptop. Most maps show many colored countries, framed by the plain blue sea. Halpern's map is exactly the opposite. Land is the shapeless border for a map of the oceans. Each color shows the degree of impact, the amount of pollution, the damage done. I talked with Ben Halpern earlier this week, shortly after he returned from the Boston meeting of the AAAS. What if we could see the cumulative impact of humans on the far-flung seas? Ben Halpern is a research scientist at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's created a computer simulation that does just that. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what does your global mapping program do?
Well, what we did is we looked at 17 different human activities ranging from climate change to commercial fishing to land-based pollution to invasive species. We took all of these different activities and layered them one on top of the other to get the big picture, sort of cumulative impact of human activities on the ocean. So in the past, people have focused on just one of these at a time. So how are humans affecting the oceans through fishing, or how are they affecting the oceans through climate change? And when you look at just one at a time, you really only get a partial picture of what's going on. So with our efforts, we wanted to get the full big picture and really understand how humans are affecting the oceans.
Well, it must be pretty complicated. I mean, you have an area where species may be weakened by, say, warmer oceans, and then you have trawlers digging up the bottom and perhaps chemicals leaking out from the coast. How can you put those together when you're doing your mapping?
That's an excellent question. We developed a very rigorous scientific method for doing exactly that, where we use ecological understanding and criteria to account for how different activities affect ecosystems differently. So, for example, nutrient runoff into coral reefs has been shown to at least potentially be a very big problem. You get algal overgrowth that kills off a lot of the corals, whereas nutrient input into, say, muddy bottoms at a river mouth probably doesn't have much of an impact. So those differences in how ecosystems respond to a particular activity are accounted for in our analysis and allow one to make these comparisons between different types of impacts in different types of ecosystems.
You know, I managed to see a copy of your video broadcast, I guess, from the deck of a boat showing the rotating Earth. One of the things that struck me was how much or how very little pristine ocean was left. Do we know how much ocean wilderness remains?
Well, what we found is that there's no single spot on the entire planet that's been untouched by human activities. So the ocean is vast, as we all know, and despite that, we've managed to affect every single spot of it. Now, that said, there are small areas that remain relatively low impacted, and so these areas probably aren't pristine, but they're probably in very good shape relative to kind of what the rest of the world looks like. And these areas, for the most part, are in the poles, in Antarctica and the Arctic. But there are small patches of these very low-impact ocean, actually throughout the world. Almost every country has at least some of this very low-impact area.
So we could create some marine conservation areas, perhaps?
Exactly. So what's really exciting about what we've done, we think, is that it helps us understand where and how much humans are having an impact on the ocean, and where this is very low, these blue spots on the map we've produced. These areas we may decide are important to protect to keep them in good condition. But they also provide a reference point for what we might want to make the rest of the area look like through restoration or mitigation efforts for those parts of the oceans that are being heavily impacted.
Well, another thing that really stood out from the mapping is that wherever there are intensive human settlements along the coasts, the oceans are in trouble. Can you name some of the hardest hit areas?
That's exactly right. I mean, where humans are the most heavily, densely populated is also where a lot of the heavy impacts are. And by far the largest, most heavily impacted places on the planet are in the North and Norwegian Seas near Great Britain and Norway, and in the South and East China Seas, which are between the coasts of China and Japan and Indonesia and Malaysia. Those are the largest, most heavily impacted places. But there are stretches of very heavy impact in the northeast of the United States, in the Puget Sound area, throughout the Eastern Caribbean, near Sri Lanka and India, as well as many other places. A lot of these places are where there are very large human populations.
I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the new United Nations Environment Report called In Dead Water. Have you seen that one?
I just did see that this last week. It's a very analogous, parallel effort. It's a slightly different focus, but it really is, I think, raising the same concerns and alarm that our report found, that, you know, we really are having a broad and significant impact on our oceans.
We're just waking up to this. Of course, all this happens way far away where nobody sees it, and we don't understand much about it. Do you think it's fair to say we're just in our baby days of understanding how the ocean works?
Well, it really is, you know, the last scientific frontier, at least on this planet. I mean, we do spend trillions of dollars exploring outer space, and there's a lot of value in that, but we still know so little about, especially the deep ocean, but the oceans in general. But that said, we actually know a lot as it is, certainly enough to be now aware of what we're doing to the ocean and enough to know, you know, ways that we can move forward in better protecting and managing our oceans. So I don't think that we are or should be held back by a sense of not knowing enough in terms of the need to better protect our oceans and strategies we can use to do that. But there is plenty of room for improvement in our understanding, because there are lots of the ocean that we just still don't know much about.
Well, I guess part of my feeling on that comes as a member of the public. Some of these announcements come as a surprise to us because we haven't learned about it in our basic school education. It's a lot of new science that's coming at us, it seems, fairly quickly. Are you seeing a more demand for activism in scientists to get this message out? You know, I mean, it could be a sense of impatience with studying an ecosystem that may be disappearing.
Well, I think it's not so much probably activism as just grave concern. I mean, you know, my colleagues and I have been studying the oceans for a while, many of my colleagues much longer than me, and we have seen in our short careers the ocean ecosystems getting worse and worse, and that is alarming to us because we know what the oceans could be like if we better manage them, and we're seeing that disappear. It's also really important to note that, you know, we get a lot of the things that we like and need from the oceans. We get fishes, you know, from fisheries. We go to the beach and enjoy swimming in the ocean. We get our water filtered through estuaries. There's a lot of services that we get from the oceans, and these services are extremely valuable. And as we degrade the ocean, the ability of the ocean to provide those services is disappearing. And that's something I think that people are just becoming aware of and realizing, that it's not just for the sake of conservation and species that we need to be paying attention to the ocean. It's for the sake of our own species, of humanity, that we need to be better managing the ocean.
We almost need a Stern report for the oceans to show their economic value.
That's right, and there have been efforts to do that. It's a very challenging thing to do, but preliminary estimates put, you know, the value at hundreds of billions of dollars a year just from the oceans, and that's almost certainly conservative.
Well, as someone who attended the recent American Academy meeting in Boston, what other ocean research really struck you?
Well, there's... There was a really interesting report that came out, actually in the same issue that our map came out, talking about a dead zone that's been formed off of the coast of Oregon that's been persistent, showing up every year for the past 6 years. And these dead zones have a variety of causes, but they are often caused by nutrient runoff from land. This one in Oregon actually is, they think, caused by climate change shifting the upwelling regime. In any case, when you get these dead zones, you get really, really low levels of oxygen, which essentially kill off all of the fish and invertebrates that live in that area, and it can have disastrous effects for fisheries and other things that people care about. And these are becoming much more common and much larger around the world, these dead zones are, and they're going to continue to do so as climate change continues, and if we don't better regulate the amount of nutrients and pollutants that we put into the water. And so these are becoming a grave concern. I think the other frontier of research right now that is alarming is the consequences of ocean acidification, and there was some talk of that at the AAAS meeting in Boston. And as we put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it changes the acidity of the oceans. It increases the acidity, and that makes it harder for organisms that build shells to make those shells. And ultimately, if the water gets too acidic, they can no longer make their shells. And this is going to have profound impacts on not just biodiversity, but a lot of things that people care about from the oceans.
If people want to find out more, do you have websites you would like to recommend?
Well, our whole project and the maps that we've produced and all the data are available at our website, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's www.nceas.ucsb.edu/globalmarine. And there you can find all the results and maps that we produced from our project. There are a lot of other resources emerging on the web for how to eat fish sustainably, how to change your daily life practices to better protect the oceans, and there are a lot of those, so I don't have any particular one to recommend.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what I'll do for our listeners. I'll put that link in my blog, which people can find at ecoshock.org, and that way be able to go right to your site. Well, I'm Alex Smith, and my guest has been Ben Halpern from the University of California, and he's sort of a new cartographer, I think, who's painted a better picture of the real state of the oceans. It was released in mid-February at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. Thank you for taking the time with us, Ben.
My pleasure.
Radio EcoShock will be right back after 30 seconds for station identification.
Warning, Radio EcoShock is not suitable for all listeners. For anyone suffering from depression, cynicism, skepticism, or despair, use your own discretion.
Side effects may include nausea, paranoia, running away, and persistent hiding. Consult your local representative if you should feel an urge for activism. I'll get back to the American scene soon enough with more on the Boston meeting, but right now we have to get off to Norway. There we find Dr. Christian Nelleman, author of the big United Nations report you've never heard about. It's called In Dead Water. Be patient with this interview. Dr. Nelleman is describing the history of the oceans we'll be leaving for coming generations. From Norway, we have Christian Nelleman on the line. He is the lead author of a new and worrying report from the United Nations. Well, I'm going to be frank with you. It hasn't received a lot of coverage yet in North America, and I think it's partly because of issues that you raised in your report that people have difficulty understanding pollution and things that happened way out at sea. How can we get that past that problem and really communicate?
Well, I think that this is absolutely everything that relates to the world oceans is actually also of major interest, even to the U.S. And I think one of the, I mean, obviously everybody has a relationship with the ocean. I mean, all the fish that we, most of the fish that we eat comes from the ocean. And there's also an additional issue, and that is what happens to the environment also actually kicks back to the U.S. in many ways, because the largest share of the world population live along the coast, and actually as many as 2.6 billion people get their primary protein. I mean, you can basically compare to the average person, McDonald's or Burger King is actually in the oceans. That's where people get their food from. And from that perspective, you know, any major change, and in this case, we're quite worried about the future of the world's fishing stocks, is going to impact a very, very large portion of the world's people, particularly in developing countries.
Well, let's try and run through some of the top human-made problems working against marine life. And the first and most obvious are the polluting chemicals and the agricultural waste and even sewage we dump right into the sea. Is that really a big threat, considering the sea is so huge?
Well, that's a very good point. But even though the oceans cover like 3/4 of the planet, over half of the world's fish are actually caught in less than 7%. So it's only a tiny fraction of the world's oceans that we really catch most of our fish. And that was one of the causes of this investigation was we've always heard, I mean, bad environmental news of different sorts, but usually, you know, problems solve themselves or get solved. But what has really is the case of what's happening now is a series of threats, including overfishing, button trawling, which is a special way of fishing that actually cuts deep into the seabed, but also coastal pollution. Now, 80% of all pollution in the ocean actually comes from land. So it's from sewage, from cities is actually one of the major pollutions, as well as agricultural runoff. Well, what basically happens is that when all this sewage runs into the to the sea, firstly acts as a fertilizer, and you get all this nasty green or even red algae in the oceans. I mean, it doesn't look like a place where you would like to go swimming. And unfortunately, most of this actually hits primarily in the main fishing grounds.
Well, your report also emphasizes important flushing mechanisms, the way the ocean recycles its own resources. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, actually, well, if we first consider these fishing grounds. Now, most of these fishing grounds around the world, including those off the coast of the United States, are located quite close to the shores. Now, firstly, as we just talked about, one of the primary problems is a lot of the pollution goes right into the ocean. Quite often, it's not even hasn't been treated anyway. Well, what we've seen, in particular off the east coast of the United States, there's been a tremendous increase in the number of dead zones, which is basically because of all the sewage running in there, you basically get areas that become completely dead. There's no life, no fish, no nothing that can actually exist there. And obviously, when that happens, all the fish dies in that particular area. Well, what scientists have now discovered is the fact that one of the reasons why this hasn't gone much, much worse and increased to a much larger extent than what we've seen so far, and it is already pretty bad. We know that the number of dead zones has increased from about 150 to over 200 in 4 or 5 years. So it's really increasing. But one of the primary problems of this is that there's a natural flushing mechanism. I mean, compare this actually to basically what happens is that during cold winters, we get an exceptionally cold winter, as we've always had in the past. The water, shallow water, seawater, it cools down and just sinks down so fast, it actually digs out entire canyons, comparable, I mean, to the Grand Canyon of the U.S., because the water cools down so fast and the currents become so strong. And it actually flushes out all the pollution from the coastal shores. It has two effects. Firstly, it cleans up our polluted shores, and it's a completely natural effect. Secondly, it brings all of these nutrients out to deep water, and that actually provides food and nutrients to a lot of the fish stocks. So it serves in two ways. First, this flushing effect cleans out the polluted waters. Secondly, it helps boost even over-harvested fish populations. The problem is that this mechanism, and it's a crucial part of all the primary fishing grounds, both off the coast of the U.S., off the East Coast, but also off the coast of Alaska and the Mexican Gulf, is that it's very, very sensitive to even slight changes in temperature. So with global warming, as is taking place now, these mechanisms may go away. And what that basically means is that the world's primary fishing grounds with this flushing mechanism, even along the coast of the United States, in the popular areas where people like to go swimming, take their families on the beach, well, if this flushing mechanism disappears, all of that pollution is not going to go away. It's just going to stay there. So we will impact not just the fishing grounds of and the fishermen and the fishing industry, and impact that as in the economy. It will also be something that people that come in decades are going to experience themselves if they take their families to the beach. So this is a very, very worrisome development.
And your report also talks a bit about the impact on the Indian Ocean and in the seas around China and Asia. Could you tell us a little bit about how this is going to impact these areas where the largest proportion of humanity lives?
Well, yes, absolutely. And one of the big concerns is even the most optimistic projections for climate change, even the most optimistic ones, still project that we may lose actually over 80% or even perhaps all of the world's coral reefs within the next 50, 60 years. Now, that's going to have a tremendous impact on tourism. It's going to have a tremendous impact on fisheries because these coral reefs are like the rainforest of the ocean. And one of the real bad things about this is that because, you know, we live on land, we don't see what's happening underneath the water. At least we haven't done much of that until now. But when these areas are going to get destroyed, it's going to have a huge impact on people, particularly in Asia. And we're talking about several billion people living directly on the coast, depending on it. And it's also actually a security issue, because not just food security, but for most of the world's impoverished populations, and we know that people that are, well, about 860 million people actually starving, it's like 3 times the population of the United States. And most of these people, they depend entirely on the world's oceans for food. And what is actually then happening now, what we can see is happening, we're actually gambling with the world's food supply. And for these people, if they lose their food resources, they lose their basic livelihoods. Well, we also risk that they're going to turn their frustration on the primary polluters in the world. So from an overall perspective, you know, it's actually about the it's about the future of all these generations, and it's about the future of a very, very large share of the world's population. And no one is going, even people that don't live off the coast, will also feel the impact of this.
Well, you raise very serious questions. Is it possible that humans will stand by and let this happen, that a whole range of commercial fisheries and a galaxy of species will just become history? What are your hopes for this report and further actions to save the sea?
Well, luckily, we know from the past that if we join forces, and if there's a strong will and intention, we can actually change the tide and actually help reduce these impacts. So I think there's an absolute clear opportunity that we can deal with these matters. However, for the first time perhaps ever in history, the time aspect is more crucial than ever. We need to reduce emissions globally, dramatically, within the next 2 decades. Because climate change is such a huge process to turn around. I mean, it's like a big tanker moving. It takes time to turn around. And if we do not act within the next 2 decades, the impacts will last for many, many, many generations, and some of the environmental impacts will last for hundreds of thousands of years. So unlike any other environmental threat that we have ever encountered before, the urgency of acting on climate change is greater than anything we've ever seen before in environmental conservation.
I'm Alex Smith, and we've been speaking with Dr. Christian Nelleman, the lead author of the UNEP report, In Dead Water. It was just released to at least 100 environment ministers at a forum in Monaco. Find it online at www.unep.org. Dr. Nelleman, thank you for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for calling us.
Okay, something happened last week in another part of the world that we can't ignore. You have heard of the Stern Report. In 2006, the British government hired an eminent economist, Sir Nicholas Stern, to calculate the coming cost of climate change compared to the cost of trying to avoid it. Now, on the other side of the globe, in Australia, the new government there has its own report. Some are calling it an updated Stern report. Dr. Ross Garnaut says Australia will pay a terrible price in climate change unless the world reduces its emissions by 90% by 2050. After years of droughts, floods, and fires, everything has turned upside down in Australian politics. They have gone from denial to truth-tellers very quickly, leaving America isolated as the last bastion of oil. Doesn't that give you hope that anyone can change? Let's listen.
We're running towards dangerous points more quickly.
Things are much worse for the world in terms of global warming than previously believed.
We've got to work harder and we've got to work faster.
We've got to have deep science-based cuts in our emissions and take a leadership role.
Our work has shown that without action, we're running towards dangerous points more quickly than a lot of the earlier analysis had suggested.
What a change in Australia. Like the new winds down under, the Labor government of Kevin Rudd has completely transformed that nation's dialogue on climate change. Instead of the coal pits of resistance by the John Howard crew, Australians are now hot and bothered by global warming. Shortly after taking office, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd ordered a report on the state of the nation's climate by economist Ross Garnaut. After studying the latest science, matched with reports of economic growth in China and all Asia, Professor Garnaut has issued his first interim report, and it's a stinger. Professor Garnaut says the world must seek a 90% reduction in greenhouse gases below the 2000 levels by 2050. He advocates that for Australia, but says one country doing it would be pointless. For a global problem, the whole world has to act in concert. Even so, he suggests that massive reduction of 90% gives us only a 50-50 chance of maintaining a livable climate. The original target set by Labor Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was a 60% reduction by 2050. That figure has been accepted by the various Australian states. But now the economist hired by the Rudd government says, quote, "Our doing that doesn't solve the global warming problem." Garnaut also recommends that the cost of greenhouse reductions has to be shared equitably. If the poor are hit too hard, there will be so much political resistance that the program will be called off, despite disastrous climate consequences. The report warns that Australia will be the country with the most to lose from global warming. Therefore, Garnaut says, Australia should be in the vanguard of all international efforts to halt climate change. The Garnaut report extends well beyond Australia. In a sense, it uses updated science, even since the latest IPCC report. It could be called, and has been called, the new Stern Report, more current than the groundbreaking climate economics document from Sir Nicholas Stern for the UK government. Now that's almost 2 years old. We have learned a lot about climate change in that time, and Australians have experienced too much of it already. Now, media down under reflects real public concern about the climate. Here is a selection of media clips from Australia, beginning with an excerpt from an ABC National interview with Ross Garnaut, February 21, 2008.
Welcome to the program, and first tonight, the blunt warning from the man commissioned by Labor to review what Australia needs to do with climate change policy. Professor Ross Garnaut says Australia potentially is the biggest loser if global solutions aren't found quickly for problems that he says are even worse than the most recent scientific predictions. Releasing the first interim report of his major greenhouse review, Professor Garnaut has flagged the need to go way beyond Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's election promise of a 60% cut in greenhouse emissions by 2050. The Garnaut review talks of global cuts in emissions of at least 90% by 2050 to have even a 50-50 chance of containing the damage. But Professor Garnaut says it's possible to dramatically change Australia's energy landscape with minimum pain. I spoke with the eminent economist from Adelaide earlier tonight. Ross Garnaut, you've said that the real picture on climate change is now much worse than the most recent UN scientific reports, which I guess were bad enough. How much worse?
Well, there's two ways in which it's worse, Kerry. One is that the outcomes are at the bad end of what the science said was going to happen. There was a range of possibilities, and the worst ones seem to be coming through in a lot of areas. But more worryingly for the future, the ongoing rate of emissions growth is much stronger than had been anticipated.
You've also said that Australia could be the biggest loser of all the developed countries. How important is it for Australia that the global temperature increase is limited to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels?
Well, you can't put a special value on 2 degrees, but 2 degrees is a number that a lot of people have settled on as a boundary beyond which things get more dangerous. But even at 2 degrees, there's significant damage, and the further you go beyond that, the greater the risks.
Is it right to say that credible science believes that even at that 2 degree increase level, you could see the Barrier Reef written off, you could see the possible collapse of the Amazon basin, you could see things like a further dangerous erosion of the stability of major ice sheets?
Yes, there's lots of risk around any of the projections. At 2 degrees, there's quite serious risk of each of those things you've mentioned happening.
This afternoon, the professor gave a media briefing on a scratchy telephone line.
Australia will be one of the most badly damaged of the developed countries if there's no effective global mitigation.
He says if the world is going to stabilise carbon emissions at 450 parts per million, as recommended by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, then Australia will have to make much deeper cuts by the year 2050. South Australian Premier Mike Rann.
My view is one of the most sobering briefings that I've seen in my 22 years in office. I mean, essentially, massive implications not only for Australia but for the world in terms of what is essentially an update of Sir Nicholas Stern's report to Britain.
The Premier say the Garnaut report should be regarded as a replacement of last year's Stern review on climate change because they say all those calculations are now out of date. New South Wales Premier Maurice Yemmer.
Professor Garnaut's work has confirmed that the growth rates in China, in India, in Vietnam, that those countries are going to continue to grow at their current rates, around 10% for China, 8 to 9% for India, and Vietnam as well, emerging as an economic superpower. And that's those growth rates in those countries are going to require more and more electricity to power their economies. So it's going to mean that there's even more urgent need for action to be taken. And a big step is a national emissions trading scheme.
We have said we would be cognizant of the science, but the government's commitment is the one we made prior to the election and that we took to the Australian people, which is a reduction of 60% by 2050. That is the approach the government will take.
Professor Garnaut will issue a draft report in June. His final report is due in September.
Sabra Lane. Those media reports were from Australia, following a revolutionary climate report by Professor Ross Garnaut, commissioned by the new government of Kevin Rudd. Expect to hear a lot from Australia in upcoming climate negotiations. Meanwhile, Garnaut recommends an emissions trading scheme, at least within Australia, if not internationally. His next report comes out next month. We started today's voyage in Boston at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. We're going to finish with a kind of revelation, something that gelled there, became clear to all during a panel discussion about a murky subject. You know we are all pouring tons of carbon dioxide into the air. Most of it, at least half, falls into the sea, that vast storage house. Perhaps you have heard that carbon becomes a kind of acid in the oceans. I knew this was a threat to tiny shell-forming animals at the bottom of the food chain. I didn't know that ocean acidification can also cause dead zones to kill every living thing, and these are popping up by the hundreds all over the world. As Dr. Nelliman told us, dead zones are forming in many parts of the world, including some off every coast of America. The causes are plenty, including trawling and especially fertilizer runoff and algae blooms, but all of these feed into the basic change in ocean chemistry brought on by excess carbon dumping. Dead zones, almost like a kind of AIDS in the oceans, are just some of the scars of the coming climate change. I'm going to read you a short but enlightening report from the Boston Conference. We're back with the Radio EcoShock All-Environment Hour. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We have talked briefly about the problem of ocean acidification. This is one of the big elephants in the room. All the plans to save us by geoengineering generally work on blocking or reducing incoming energy from the sun. Some reputable scientists have suggested we may have to blast tiny mirrors into space or even pollute the atmosphere with more sulfur just to stop a global warming tragedy. These plans assume humans will continue to use fossil fuels as long as they last. The big problem, even if we could reduce sunlight, a horrible and desperate idea on its own, our carbon emissions are poisoning the sea, turning it towards acid. Even worse, we are just beginning to learn that the victims of ocean acidification are not just tiny creatures we can't see. As we will hear now, scientists at the latest meeting of the American Academy were abuzz about the impacts of throwing so much carbon into the sea. I found a really clear explanation for you, the best I have seen on this subject. Finally, I got the picture, and I think you will too. This article appeared in the journal Ars Technica, The Art of Technology. Rather than hack it up, I'm just going to read you this short article, with the permission of the author, John Timmer, science editor for Ars Technica. The title is AAAS, The Other Carbon Problem, Ocean Acidification. It was published February 15, 2008, from the annual conference of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. Here is what John Timmer writes. Friday morning's first sessions included a series of talks on what was termed the other carbon problem, ocean acidification. When dissolved in water, carbon dioxide can combine with a single water molecule to form carbonic acid, a process that ultimately lowers the pH of the water. On a global scale, adding more CO2 to the atmosphere will trigger this process to occur on a massive scale. So far, the oceanic pH has dropped by just 0.1 units, but it's expected to drop another 0.3 points in the next century unless emissions are curbed. Speakers in the session included Peter Brewer and James Berry of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, Ulf Ribesell of the Leibniz Institute of Marine Sciences in Kiel, Germany, and Andrew Knoll of Harvard. The issues they discussed are complex and interrelated, so I'm going to rearrange some of their points to give this description a more logical flow. The panel presented two reasons we should care about oceanic pH. The first is a matter of basic physiology, covered by Berry. Most respiration processes in higher organisms produce CO2. So basic chemistry says that the more CO2 that is present in the environment, the less efficiently these reactions will run. Ultimately, that will lead to the energy cost of basic living going up, and that price will have to be paid in terms of reduced growth and/or reproduction. Berry suggested that this cost will be paid in terms of reduced productivity of the oceans and longer generation times, making it harder for species to undergo evolutionary adaptation to the changing conditions. Peter Brewer also noted that the dynamics of depth, pressure, and temperature would actually produce permanent dead zones at some depths, where the CO2-oxygen ratios are too low to support efficient respiration. This is apparently already happening in some tropical ocean regions. This could eventually play havoc with what he termed the planet's largest animal migration, the migration of most oceanic life from the surface to the intermediate depths during daylight hours. Ribesell also pointed out that carbon's ability to fertilize algal life might exacerbate this problem by creating growth booms that further deplete the oxygen. The second reason for concern is for animals that rely on calcium carbonate for skeletal elements, as this mineral will dissolve in acidic media. Although this will impact shellfish and echinoderms, the big losers here are coral. Ribocell showed figures that indicated that by 2070, it is likely that the optimal growth conditions for warm water coral will simply no longer exist, and about 60% of the environment for cold water coral will be gone. Ribocell also got into why we should care. He pointed that out of 18 measures of environmental services evaluated by one group, corals provided 15, ranging from being a tourist draw to providing physical shelter for the ocean. More generally, Berry showed figures indicating that oceanic environments with reduced biodiversity are more prone to both boom and bust cycles and total collapse, meaning that this stress may ultimately limit humanity's ability to rely on the ocean as a food source. The geological record, as presented by Noel, suggested that Brewer's statement, quote, "Nobody's been able to find anything really good about this," end quote, was reasonably accurate. Brewer had noted that the oceans hadn't seen pHs this low for 40 million years, but Noel extended the record 10 times further back. During the Ordovician, atmospheric carbon levels were much higher but had risen gradually, allowing the oceans to remain saturated with calcium carbonate, and life had flourished. But 250 million years ago, the formation of the Siberian Traps through a massive volcanic eruption caused a sudden and massive shift in oceanic pH, and nearly 90% of oceanic species went extinct. He noted that the extinctions followed lines that were predictable. Species we'd expect to be sensitive to carbonate concentrations died, while those that have finer control over their physiology largely made it through the extinctions. His take-home is not that we have to worry about simply having lower oceanic pH, but that we do need to worry about the rate of change. Ribocell echoed that by noting that species with rapid generation times will be better able to adapt. The basic conditions will also produce some winners. Cyanobacteria, green algae, and dinoflagellates were all mentioned. In the historic analysis, however, corals come out as losers. Not only do they have a relatively long generation time, but they have evolved after the first high carbon period Noel spoke of, and so have never faced conditions like those we're heading for. The big uncertainties were discussed in two forms. The first is feedback loops, such as the carbon fertilization mentioned above. Several talks also mentioned how bacteria, when oxygen-starved, start using other molecules for oxidation reactions, which could start pumping other greenhouse gases, various nitrogen oxides were mentioned, into the oceans and the atmosphere. The other uncertainty was how to set a target point that we want to avoid reaching. Here the panelists agreed there was no scientific way to put a hard number on what degree of change and extinction could be tolerated. The discussion that followed ultimately provided the best perspective on what this means. It happened too quickly to attribute quotes to individuals, but I will share some of them below. We're entering a new geologic era. We talk about it calmly in a way that's not appropriate for the scale of what we are doing. Society now is not willing to pay the tab for a lot of things. We are inflicting these changes and all this chaos on those who will come later. Morally wrong and, I think, unnecessary. End quote. Generally, it was described as a tragedy of the commons, where the commons exists in time, in that the tragedy will be faced by generations that are not born yet. Well, that ends my reading of an article by science editor John Timmer in the journal Ars Technica, February 15, 2008, on ocean acidification. My thanks to John for permission to broadcast his fine piece. Find it at arstechnica.com. That's it for Radio EcoShock for this week. As we witness the awful impact of climate change, of our fossil fuel civilization on our defenseless oceans. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for caring enough to listen. Check out our website and my blog, plus lots of free green audio at www.ecoshock.org.